Good morning, everybody. How are you today? This is Celeste Duckworth, and I'm your host for A Taste of Ink Live today. Today we have author Toni Schumacher. So I hope that, you know, you're listening in, and remember that if you've missed this time, there will be a rebroadcast of this program. We're doing this interview live with Toni, who's in the UK right now in London. So I'm going to get a few things out the way first. We want to say thank you to our business sponsor. Our business sponsor is AlkaLogic. They do alkaline water. I don't know if you've ever tried alkaline water, but it really does supercharge your body. It's a great way to feel healthy and, you know, drink healthy. So you can contact AlkaLogic at 1-844-344-2552 or go to their website at www.alkalogic.com. And if you talk to them before the end of this year, you'll be able to get a 10% discount if you mention Vertical 10. Mention Vertical 10 for a 10% discount on any system. And thank you again, AlkaLogic, for being our business sponsor. And I just want to let you know, if you're going to call in and ask questions, please make sure you're in a little area that's a little bit quiet. We want to try to keep the background noise down. Our intro music today was Deep Undercover by Steve Thompson and the Incidents. You can find more of their music and a little bit information about them. They're from the United Kingdom as well. And you can find them at facebook.com/theincidents. I've also posted that in our chat room. So anybody that wants to hear more of them, you know, definitely go to their site. They have the links up there and you can reach them. So now, I'm excited about our author that we have today. We're part of the same networking group. And I just have to say that I'm an avid reader from, you know, little when I was very young. And I haven't read a book of this magnitude that really excited me when it comes to this particular genre since The Burkitt. And, you know, I don't know if anybody's read that book by Joseph Heywood. So I had an opportunity to read The Darkest Hour. And it's a really exciting book. It's a great story. It's one that really draws you in. So I'm hoping that you have we're not only going to talk to Toni about his book, but a little bit about his writing as a writer, his life as a writer. Definitely call in with your comments and with your questions. So just a little bit about Toni. He said in his intro that he has been a builder, a bouncer, has worked at a garbage dump, drove a taxi, worked on board a cruise ship selling underwear, and was a British bobby for 10 years or so. He's even performed stand-up comedy and has acted on the stage and screen, has been a regular on radio stations all around the UK and made films in the BBC. One of the things that he said on here that I loved is that he makes amazing coffee and spends his days looking out the window while drinking it. So Toni is the author of Rearview Mirror, Stories from the Street and the Night, The Darkest Hour, and his new book has just been released called The British Lion. So definitely, you know, welcome Toni to the program. We're looking forward to being able to ask him some questions about the book. So while we're waiting to get Toni to dial in, we always have a little bit of a delay when we have writers calling in from other from overseas. I'm going to just read you a little bit of the synopsis for The Darkest Hour. I don't want to give away The British Lion yet, but the synopsis for The Darkest Hour, because The Darkest Hour is actually, The British Lion is actually kind of a sequel to The Darkest Hour. London, 1946, the Nazis have conquered the British, and now occupy Great Britain, using brutality and fear to control its citizens. John Henry Rosset, a decorated British war hero and former police surgeon, has been reassigned to the Office of Jewish Affairs. He now answers to the SS, one of the most powerful and terrifying organizations in the Third Reich. Rossett is a man accustomed to obeying commands, but he's now assigned a job he did not ask for and cannot refuse rounding up Jews for deportation, including men and women he's known his whole life. But they're not the only victims of the war. The war has taken his wife, his son, and shattered his own humanity. So that's just a brief synopsis of The Darkest Hour. And I would love all of you to welcome Tony Schumacher to our show. And I just want to give a shout out. My bonus son, who's in London, shout out to you, Mark. Love you. Miss you. I know he's listening today, and I just want to say that. And the rest of my good friends there in the UK that I haven't seen in a long time, thank you for your support, as well as everyone that supports Vertical Life. Hi, Tony. How are you today?
Hello, Celeste, and hello to everyone who's sitting there listening to me.
Are you having your amazing coffee right now?
I am. People won't know, but I sent you a message and then I hung up really quickly because I had to run downstairs because I'd forgotten my cup in the kitchen and I had to grab my cup of coffee and then charge back upstairs frantically. So I just sat down. I've got my nice cup of coffee. It's here. It's right by the microphone. I don't know if you can hear it. It's about to go.
That's great. Well, Tony, thank you for saying yes to coming on the program, especially having your second book launched yesterday, right?
That's right, and thank you for having me, more to the point. It's just been a crazy couple of days. You go into that, there's like a crazy kind of thing happens where, as a writer, you're kind of sitting alone, you know, doing nothing. You're just sort of looking out the window all day and then doing a little bit of writing every now and then. And then all of a sudden everything goes absolutely crazy for a couple of weeks where people are asking you to talk to them and stuff. And I love it. It's so exciting. It's brilliant.
That's fantastic. Considering all the jobs that you had, and I read one thing you said was that you found your calling as a writer after having all this job. That's really how you feel?
Absolutely. It sounds a bit trite when you say it, but it's absolutely true that I kind of feel like I've sort of come home. You know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a writer, but I was incredibly dumb when I was at school. I was like me and school just didn't get along at all. And I found it really difficult. I just wasn't cut out for it. And so I just wanted to leave. And then when I got my, in the UK, we have these things, or we used to, I think it's probably changed now because I'm getting old, but we used to have a thing called O levels, which were kind of like your high school diploma, you know. And I failed mine terribly, really, really badly. And I thought I'd blown my chance of doing this one dream, this one thing to be a writer. And luckily enough, all these years later, you know, it's like 35 maybe, yeah, about 30-odd years later, I've finally got it. I've finally, you know, arrived where I need to be.
That's fantastic, and I can totally relate to that thought, because I know I had English teachers would say, no, just write the lesson and stop being creative. So I could totally understand that.
Most of mine just told me to get out of the classroom, to be honest with you.
I wonder if, have you ever seen any of your teachers now that you're a writer?
I did an article for a newspaper in the UK about 6 months ago about education and how it works for some people and it doesn't work for other people, you know. And I got, about a week later, I went to a book event in Liverpool, where I live in the UK. And at the book event, an old teacher came walking up to me who had read the article in the newspaper. And I kind of felt a bit embarrassed, not because anything I'd said wasn't true, but it was just, you know, you're coming up to someone who kind of let you down a little bit, you know, when you were a kid. And she was lovely, because what she said was she'd felt that they hadn't done a good job. They felt, you know, the teachers, it was like an inner city kind of school that I went to, and it wasn't a very good school, and you know, and the kids weren't that bright either. You know, I mean, we've got to take some of the blame for it, but it was nice because you realise that it's difficult for everyone in that situation, including the teachers, and it gave me a different outlook. You know, and she bought a book as well, which is always good.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not complaining that way, you know.
Well, you said that for the book, The Darkest Hour, you said it took you 46 years to write. What did you mean by that?
Well, because, like I say, when I was a kid, there was one thing I always wanted to do, and it was be a writer. And I never, you know, when I was a little kid, I used to have a friend who sadly passed away now, but I used to have a friend, and we used to write comics together, you know, like... you know, we'd sit down and we'd do these like little stories together and stuff. And I'd felt like I'd started writing The Darkest Hour then, even though it wasn't that, it wasn't this book and it wasn't these themes that I was writing about. It was like I'd started that story with those comics that were totally unrelated to what I ended up doing. But I just felt like that I'd started it, and I'd never really done that writing part of it justice. And it was only when I started writing the book, you know, out of them 46 years, only the final two were spent writing the book. But it was that thing about it was all leading up. Everything I'd done, every job, everything I'd done led to that one point when I started writing the book, because there's a lot of my life experiences in there, you know.
Right. That's what I want to ask you, you know, how much of your own life experience was in the book, or how much, you know, as far as events or based on people that you knew or that you know was part of that book for you.
When I wrote the book, I didn't really think there was any of me in it. And it's kind of funny that at the time there was a lead character in the book called John Ross. And John is a guy who's been through a lot, and he's come up against a fair bit of adversity, and he's been down, and he's gradually clawing his way back to being, you know, where he should be, happier kind of thing. Now, at the time, I didn't realise that was actually me. It had never occurred to me when I was writing it, but it was when I look back at it now, I think it was therapy, but it just had never occurred to me that it was somebody pointed out to me that, oh, wow, this is you, isn't it? And I went, no. And they said, no, it is, because he's done this and he's been there and he's done that. And when I saw that, I realised, yeah, it was me. And it had never occurred to me. So I'm there. I'm actually there, you know, but what and all.
Have people that you know who read the book, have they told you that after they read the book that they could identify some things that really were you?
Lots of people have, and lots of people think I did it on purpose, but I didn't. You know, I keep telling people that none of it was intentional. I think it's just a weird thing that I think every writer does this. Even if you're writing a blog, or even if you're writing anything you write, even a shopping list. Anything has got you in it. Anything. Because there's nothing more intimate with yourself than sitting down and writing. That's why writing love letters and stuff like that is always so much better than telling someone you love them, because it's intimate. It's just you, a piece of paper, maybe a pen, maybe a keyboard. There's nothing gets in the way of that. You know, and more often than not, because you don't even know if anyone's going to read it. So you can be honest.
Yes.
So it does kind of come out, you know, it does come out and you don't realize it.
I agree with you there. Now, the perspective of the UK being in league with Germany, what kind of research did you do for that? Because for me, reading The Darkest Hour, it really creating a stunning, clear picture to me is like, you know, in fact, you know, I was reading it, and I was like, okay, I have to remember my history here. Like, you know, there were some parts that just like, I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, tell me, you know, what kind of research did you do to help you with events, or to create your own perspective of how it was back in that time?
I've always been really interested in that era, because where I live, Liverpool, was really heavily bombed. It, during the war, the Germans used to send over, we called it the Blitz. I mean, I'm telling you, all you guys probably know this, but
yes,
we called it the Blitz, and they bombed the UK, you know, and they were trying to beat Great Britain into submission. Now, where my parents lived was an area called Scotland Road in Liverpool. It's like a big,
okay,
a very, very densely populated area in Liverpool then. Right by the docks, unfortunately. So everyone got bombed. You know, they literally, every night, if you research, you know, the Liverpool Blitz, where they just bombed it for night after night after night. Now, my mother was, their house was hit. They were hiding under the kitchen table. And my mother and her brother and her mum were, the house collapsed around them, you know, and they had to get dug out of the house. So that was a story that I'd heard as a kid. And that kind of, it sowed the seeds, you know, because you can't hear stories like that and not be affected by them, you know. So
that's
it sows the seed of that interest. And then all my life I've always, you know, I read a lot of stuff and I've read a lot of stuff about that era. But then the historical aspects of the invasion, whether or not the Germans could have managed to invade the UK, truth be told, they probably couldn't. You know, it would have took so many, you know, imponderables to line up to make it happen.
Yeah.
But potentially it could have happened. And most of the characters, most of the kind of characters on the edge of the book, the big guys, you know, the kings and prime ministers and stuff, everything that happens to those guys could have happened. They were all real people who had real opinions. Like in the second book, The British Lion, I got, you know, some people kind of criticised me a little bit for saying that Lindbergh was the prime minister, was the president of the USA. And then, but when you point to the fact that Lindbergh was a great admirer of Hitler, and only 2 or 3 years before the war was looking at buying houses in Berlin. And you suddenly realise that, you know, this is a guy who we see very differently from, you know, the public image of someone who, you know, is a hero and a great man.
Right.
And, you know, during the war, once he realised, you know, who he was and what was going on, he made a big effort to join up. You know, unfortunately, he couldn't. But one thing I would like to say is that, you know, these large issues and these large kind of themes in the book, there was one thing I was always really trying to do, and that was making the book about individuals, about the little people, you know, the people who were like, you know, the ones who were just struggling and trying to get through on a day-to-day basis. So although it's you know, there's a big geopolitical theme there, it's more, to me, it's more important about the poor people who were, you know, having to put up with that kind of life.
Right, right. And I think you did a great job, because even though we do, you know, even though you hear those stories from, you know, from relatives, I think what was unique for me is that the way the book was written, it could really, you know, like you said, it really could have, one small bit could have changed in that direction.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Right, and that's why I really liked the way you did it, because it was a great read, okay? Because I'm an avid history fan, so it's always a great read for me when someone can manipulate that history in such a way when they're writing that you can really say, you know what, a small event, this could really have happened, you know, and these are real people that were affected by that particular time in history.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's like, I also really enjoy like the period details, you know, and sort of reading about, you know, that time of life and watching old, you know, movie tone kind of footage. And, you know, I love all of that. That for me is great, you know. And also I would have liked to sort of sample that life. And this is the easiest way I get to do it. And it's easier than building a time machine. I can sit down and just pretend I'm there, you know. So I love all of that. It's great for that.
Yes, I did,
you know?
Too. Yeah, I did too. I love the little, you know, the little bits that you put in there, you know, the look, the thoughts, the, you know, the feelings. But really the things are like, you know, you probably wouldn't think about them, but like you said, like you're having your coffee there, you know?
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't think about, you know, you're just thinking, oh, you know, he's just having his coffee. But when you think about what you might be looking at and the thoughts that might be running through your head, it really does a great job in creating those pictures. It really does.
Well, it makes it fun. It makes it fun to write. I was in an antique shop the other week in London, and I was just kind of killing time. I was doing something else, and I was just kind of killing time in this antique shop, and I ended up playing with an old radio from the 40s. I was just looking at this radio, and I loved the feel of things. I loved the feel of, like, how switches feel when you turn them, because for me that's an important little kind of tiny detail that colours in the gaps of a story. I love that, you know.
Right.
And so that's why I'm so lucky that I can sit in an antique shop playing with the radio turning it off and on just so I can feel the resistance of the switch and call it work. I'm the luckiest man on earth, you know. It's just my job. It's brilliant.
Right. So tell me, was there a certain scene in The Darkest Hour that was harder for you to write than other scenes?
Oh, gosh, yeah. You know, there's... You know, you have to put yourself in situations. I think the most difficult scene for me, and I kind of laugh when I say it, but there's a little boy in the book who becomes very close to John. He basically saves John in that he gives John, you know, it sounds trite when you say it, but he gives him his soul back. He gives him something else to think about and someone to care about and someone to love. And there's a little scene in the book where Jacob, the little boy, holds John's hand, and it's kind of a weird sensation for Rossett, for John, because he's lost any kind of human contact, and he feels that he's completely devastated. And there's a scene where Jacob holds his hand, not because he's, you know, not because he's scared as such, but because I think the child realises that Rossett just needs someone to hold his hand. And that upset me when I wrote it, because I think we all need that sometimes, you know. And it when you suddenly realise that as a writer, it's a great thing, but it's also a bit kind of distressing, really, when you realise that sort of feeling that, you know what, occasionally we all need that. Be it a fictional character in the book or a real person. And often we don't get it. And it's nice to...
Yeah.
So I found that difficult, I'll be honest with you. That was kind of upsetting. And there's other kind of traumatic stuff in there, you know, which is just to visit the emotions of those people who, you know, were involved in the Holocaust and that kind of misery. Just to even visit them emotions, it can be quite horrible at times, you know. It really can. That's why I drink a lot of coffee.
Well, how do you push through those feelings? Because I know a lot of writers, and I mean pretty much any writers that are writing about anything that has to do with somebody's humanity, you know, they have to. You know, you can't do it without feeling that, and then also. When it comes to making your story authentic, you know, you might have to go a little bit deeper than others. But how do you push back? How do you push away from that or push through that?
You just, I don't even know if it do, to be honest with you. I think you've just got to keep plowing through. I think you've just got to keep going through. And there's a theme about, you know, trying to be better in the books. You know, it's something that I'm quite, you know, as much as it's a thriller and, you know, it's a crime thriller, I wanted it to have that kind of undercurrent of meaning something as well. I want it to be entertaining. Oh, you know, please, you know, let it be entertaining. But
yeah.
I want it to be more than that. And I want people to think about stuff. And if it takes me being a bit fed up after writing something and feeling maybe a bit down for the day or two, But it makes people think about it. I'll go with that. You know, that's a price to pay. And also, you know, I mean, you know, I've got good friends and stuff, and you can talk to good friends when you're feeling like that. But it does get you down. There's no getting away from it.
Yes.
There were times when I was writing it, you know, that it kind of becomes oppressive. But the one thing that I've got, the one thing of my favour that I've got that I can always look forward to is I know that, you know, John's doing the right thing. John is, yes. You know, he's doing the right thing. Eventually, he's doing the right thing. So I can take solace from the fact that, yeah, you know, humans will hopefully, in the end, do the right thing.
Well, I want to ask you now because, you know, before I go into your, you know, some questions about your new book, I want to ask you, how did that feel when, you know, to be in a, and I don't want to, let's see, I don't want to tell this. You actually, you're in, we're in the same networking group. So how did that feel when you went through, you know, when you started really promoting this book and you started talking to people for you to get an offer from HarperCollins? How did that feel when you first
it's such a crazy story. I'll tell you briefly. I was driving a cab. I'd been a cop for a long time, and a lot of stuff went wrong for me, which I will come to, you know, later. But I was driving a cab, and I'd kind of stumbled across writing the book by having a question, and the question was, you know, would I have behaved as badly as some people did during the war? And we all like to say, oh yeah, you know, I wouldn't do anything wrong, but I'm sure that a lot of the people who lived through that horrible period of history all thought that they wouldn't be the people who would do things, you know, that evil. And I was asking myself, the reason that's what started me writing the book was that I was asking myself, would I do these things, you know, and I couldn't answer it, so that's why I started writing a book. So I finished the book, and a guy got in touch with me. I was writing, whilst I was doing that, I was writing little magazine articles and stuff, and these articles were just about being a taxi driver and being a cop and little snapshots of life, you know, on the streets. And then there's a group called Stoosh PR, STOOSHPR, and they're kind of a networking group set up by a lady called Jane in New York, who's an amazing, generous person, and she's very well connected to PR, and she understands how cultural and media industries work, and she set up this group to give free advice to idiots like me who know nothing about PR, who know nothing about any kind of marketing and stuff. But very generously, she set up this group, and it's full of great people who share stuff and communicate and support and, you know, offer advice, and the amazing place that people like yourself, you know, it's just an amazing place full of positive energy, which is so important, especially in this job, because there's very few jobs in the world, other, you know, that just repeatedly punches you in the face, and that is working in creative industry, because it's full of rejection. It's constantly rejection. So it's nice to have nice people around you. Well, I'd written an article, and a guy called Col Berry, B-U-R-Y, which is like an English spelling a berry, got in touch with me, and he said, wow, I enjoyed this little article you've done. Have you done anything else? And I said, well, funny enough, I've just finished a book. Now, Col was involved in a Stoosh PR. I said, I've just finished a book. It was the first decent length thing I'd ever written. It was like 120,000 words. And Col said to me, well, you know, I know an agent who's kind of supported me, you know, and he said, I've never managed to get anything published with this guy at that point. He said, I've never managed to get anything published. Would you like me to let him read your book? And I'd literally finished it about 2 weeks beforehand, and I thought, oh, hang on, you know, do I give it, because it might be rough, it might be rubbish, and I might, you know, let myself down. Anyway, I hummed and hawed, and my then girlfriend, who's since seen sense and moved on, said to me, just send it to him. Send it, and you've nothing to lose. No, just go for it. And this is the thing that I always say to people, take that chance. If it's there, you know, don't hesitate, go for it, you know. And so I did, and I sent the book, and a week later, maybe 10 days later, I got an email back off a guy called Nat Sobel, and Nat is my agent now, but I didn't know at the time, but he's like a legendary New York literary agents. And he wow. sent me this thing, and he said, Tony, Colin sent me your book. You've got an amazing future ahead of you. Call me. And that was just, because I've been working nights, you know, I just done a 12-hour night. You know, it was just an awful, awful night. And when you get an email like that, I'm still now, it's like 2 years later, and I still can't believe it. I just still can't believe it. I've been so lucky, and I've been so lucky to meet such supportive, amazing people. And that's a lesson for everyone, by the way. You know, you go to, people do like, I haven't, but people do like lots of writing courses, and people do lots of, you know, things, how to be successful at stuff. And mm-hmm. really, I swear, the easiest one thing, save your money, don't buy the how-to books. The one thing is, be generous with people, and they'll be generous with you. Because that's all that has happened with. And it mm-hmm. really works, and that's how you're going to do it, you know? Keep going and be generous.
That's great advice, Tony. Well, I want to talk about the British Lion a little bit. Just for all of you that's listening, it is a riveting sequel to The Darkest Hour. And actually, I can't wait to read it because, you know, when I was reading the synopsis, I was like, oh, no, I really got to read this because it's kind of an interesting, you know, just an interesting twist of what I was, you know, have already read. But I wanted to just give you a little bit of, for all you listening, just a little bit of a part of a customer review on The British Lion. They say it's a historical fiction based on an alternate version of World War II. The Nazis have won the war and taken over Britain. The U.S. is supporting Hitler. Wow, this might sound crazy on the surface. Tony shows us how easily it could have occurred. We see how one little event, just what we just got through talking about, can change history. So now, Tony.
Just, sounds great, doesn't it? Yeah, I wanted to read really, this book.
Oh, yeah, I'm like, I was like, I didn't even read the whole customer review because I was like, wow, this is like amazing, you know? And I don't even know if I could top that review.
I hope you can.
So, like, you know, do you read your reviews and do you respond to them, good or bad, or do you, you know, what is your advice before we go into the book about reviews?
You know what? My advice is don't read them, but the truth is that I do, and there's no getting away from it, you know. And you might get 25 star reviews, and then you get one bad one, and it's just the worst thing in the world. On my wall. Just behind me, on the wall behind me, I've got a clipping from the Wall Street Journal, and mm-hmm. A friend sent it to me in the States, and it's a really good review of the first book in the Wall Street Journal. Now, this is like, well, exactly, it's amazing, and I still can't believe that it's there. That's why I stuck it on the wall, just in case I dreamed it, I can look up and see that it's actually there. But you know, when one guy sends you a bad review on Amazon or something, you forget the good stuff. Immediately, all the good stuff goes completely out the window, including the Wall Street Journal and the Fort Worth Star and, you know, all of these papers. It all goes out the window because you just can't help but be hurt by bad reviews. But I never, and I only respond to ones where I think people want a response. Occasionally, on Goodreads, I think Goodreads is kind of good because people are very creative and deep thinking on Goodreads. And I think sometimes you get a really good review. When I say good review, what I mean is that you can tell that somebody's took their time to think about what they're writing and to really make an effort with it. So occasionally I will thank people on Goodreads because I think that if they took that time, I owe it to them to kind of acknowledge that, you know, and to think that. But with Amazon, you know, my publisher will go crazy when I say it, but I can't help it. I do. I read them all. It's awful. It really is. It's just awful.
Yeah. Well, I have a question, but before I answer this person's question, tell me a little bit about, you know, because clearly when you read The Darkest Hour, you know, you want it to go on. So did you have any idea when you wrote The Darkest Hour that you would write a sequel to it?
I didn't, but about 5 minutes after I got the email off Nat saying I had an amazing future, I was talking to him on the phone, nearly crying. I've got to be honest with you, because I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And almost immediately he was saying to me, this is a character, you know, you can't let him go. John is a guy who you can't let go. You've got to think about a future for John. Because I wasn't even sure if I was going to write another book. I didn't even know. It was something that I wanted to do to answer a question myself. And at that point,
right.
You know, I didn't think, you know, it's kind of weird, really, but I didn't know if I had the confidence in myself to think that what I'd written was any good and if it was worth my while, you know, doing it again. And then it was immediately then I realised, well, hang on, I must be all right, you know, so I'll write another one. But not initially there wasn't a sequel in mind, but almost immediately there was. And I can tell you now, you're one of the first people to know, but HarperCollins have asked me for the third book only 2 days ago. So, you know, it's going okay, and John will be back again and again, I think, hopefully. Until he gets tired of me. He might get tired of me in the interim. I don't know what I might get tired of him. But we'll see what happens.
Do you have any other books that you're writing now?
I've got a couple of ideas kind of on the back burner, which I'm sort of thinking about that I've got. You know, I've made little starts on just to explore different ideas and stuff like that. But what tends to happen is that I'm quite kind of. Obviously, writing a book takes up a fair bit of time, although I'm lucky that I'm doing it full time, so it's at least I can dedicate my life to it. But I do kind of like to think about other ideas, and, you know, so there's a couple of other ideas that I've got, you know, which I'm sort of holding on to, which I think might potentially be something.
Any possibility of a movie?
Oh, well, I hope so.
Out of these two books?
I hope so. There's been a little bit of talk, but it's the nature of the industry, you know, and the timing is important as well, you know, that you've got to, everything's got to line up and stuff, but there is kind of talk. It's a recurring theme that keeps cropping up in reviews and, you know, I can't even remember what newspaper it was now, but there was a newspaper in the States that said it was it reminiscent of Alfred Hitchcock or Carol Reed, who directed The Third Man, you know, the classic of all time movies. So there's kind of that kind of attracted a little bit of interest and stuff. But to be honest with you, that's kind of where your agent comes into it. And like Nat is very good in that he vaguely talks about this stuff, but whenever I ask about it, he just tells me, just get on with writing, do your job, you know what I mean? Just keep writing, I'll do my job, you do your job, you know, and so that's the thing. So, but I, you know, you hope so, if nothing else, you know, it'll be nice.
So how long did it take you to write The British Lion as compared to writing The Darkest Hour?
It almost fell out of me. I was getting a bit worried point, because I started thinking that maybe I was doing something wrong, but I would say that it took me about the first draft, probably about 5 months, and then to get it to publication standards was about 8 months, I think, 8 and a half, maybe 9 months, when it was all done, and that's, for me, was astonishing. That the Darkest Hour took me a little bit longer, you know, but and that was only a first. But this, I think because I knew the characters and I had a theme that I wanted to achieve with the book, so it kind of was pretty. Also, I don't really plan a lot, you know, when I'm writing, I don't really do that much planning. I like to write by the seat of my pants, you know, and just charge along and see where it goes. So more often than not, I write quickly because I want to know what's going to happen next.
Oh, let me ask you though now. I saw you have another book, Rear View Mirror, and that's more different, quite a few stories in one book. Was it easy for you to go from doing like little short stories and articles to actually writing a full-fledged novel?
Writing Rearview Mirror came about because it was a series of. I was driving a cab one night in Liverpool, and it was a miserable night. I wasn't making any money, and it was rubbish, and I was really, sick of life. And I picked up a lady called Angie Salmons, who's a magazine editor over here, and we were chatting, and I asked her what she did. Typical taxi driver, British taxi driver, asking questions. And she said, "Oh, I'm editor of magazine." And I said, "Oh, I do a bit of writing." And I hadn't written anything in like 35 years. Ridiculous. And she said, "Okay, well, send me some of your stuff." So what I did was I came up with the idea of writing little short stories about things that happened in the taxi. Now, these would be about 1,000 words long, like a blog post almost, a little bit more, about the length of a blog post. And what Angie taught me was that with every 1,000 words, you can lose 250. There's never any doubt. You could always lose about 250 words out of anything you've written. So she taught me about brevity. She taught me about, being self-critical and structure and story arcs, which is all stuff. Like I say, I didn't learn any of this at school because I just wasn't really paying attention. If it wasn't outside the window, I wasn't interested. So she taught me a lot in a very short space of time, and that made the jump from writing those short stories about the taxi, that made the jump from writing a book a lot easier for me, because what it did was I already had those tools. I just hadn't made anything as big, but I already had the tools, So I kind of went from like, building a barbecue to building a house kind of thing, but the principles are essentially the same. You just got to do more of it, really. That's all,
Well, I have a couple of questions from you from our listeners. The first question is, who is your favorite author, and what is it that really strikes you about their work?
Let's see. I would say, at the moment, do you know who I really like? Okay, who I really like? British writers hate me because I love American authors. For some weird reason, I've always really enjoyed American authors. And when I was younger, I spent a bit of time in the States and stuff. So I've always had a real affinity for American. I love all of that kind of thing. So I would say, possibly Robert Crace. I like Robert Crace. And what I like about Robert Crace is, one, is it goes back to brevity. His writing is very, very stripped back and very tight. But he also manages to have a little bit of humor in his work. And I've seen the guy speak, and you can see how that comes across out of him. And I like the idea that maybe I can try and emulate that little bit of humor, because sometimes you need a little bit of light in these worlds, So I like Robert Crace. I love Philip Roth. I love Philip Roth because it sometimes goes exactly against everything I've just said. So if you want, just ignore me completely. But I like Philip Roth because sometimes he'll use 5 or 6 words where he should use one. So he counters everything I've just said. But he's got the luxury of being established, and he's got the luxury of an audience who know what they're getting. But I like what he does because sometimes he makes sentences like really, I'm trying to think of the way, comfy, really nice, and they kind of, you sink down into them, I love that. And Cormac McCarthy, because he just makes me cry. I'm terrible for crying. I'm the worst in the world, and books like The Road just have me blubbing. Honestly, I'm terrible. So Those three, off the top of my head, I'll say those three.
Okay, and the next question was, do you have to travel much concerning your book? So I'm thinking they're meaning, do you travel to maybe places you haven't been to as part of referencing for your book?
There's a funny story with the books, that initially they were going to be set in France. I was going to set them in occupied France, as opposed to the UK, because I worried about the work involved in painting that world of an occupied Great Britain. So I thought, I know, I'll put them in occupied France, or I'll put it in occupied France. But I couldn't afford to go because I was driving a taxi. So I thought, my imagination is cheaper than buying a flight to Paris. So I'll set them in the UK, and that was that. Today, London, I know London pretty well where the books are set. So I'm quite lucky that my best friend lives in London and I spend a lot of time up there with him. So nearly all of the places in the book I know quite intimately anyway. There's a funny story though. There's a pub in The Darkest Hour, the first book, at the end of the book. It's an amazing pub. If anyone's ever in London, they should get along to this pub. It's called The Prospect of Whitby Pub, and if you Google it, it's a really old, it's like a 16th century pub on the banks of the River Thames, and it's a real, you know, snapshot of what London was 600-700 years ago. It's an amazing place. Well, I'd never been to the Prospect of Whitby, but I set it there for a particular reason that I needed in the book. And I'd never been, and months and months later, I was going past in a taxi, and I saw the pub and thought, right, quick, I'm going to the pub, you know. So we stopped the cab, and I jumped out, and I went into the Prospect, and it was exactly the same as the book. So whether or not I've been there in a past life, I had no idea, but it was astonishing. And my PR, it was with me. Helen, who runs the PR for me with HarperCollins, couldn't believe it, because she didn't believe that I hadn't been to the book, because it's exactly the same as it is in the book. So I don't know what happened there.
Oh, wow.
Hopefully,
well, like you said, it could be a past life experience.
Possibly. Or maybe all 16th century pubs look the same, maybe. I don't know, you know, it could be that. I've got it, but we're hoping to do, if we can get a bit of interest in the States about doing a tour or something like that next year, you know, we're talking about doing something like that, and maybe traveling around America and doing some talking as well.
Well, I have one more question, and they're asking, if you had to do it all over again, is there anything that you would change in your latest book?
Wow. If I had to do my whole life all over again, there's loads of things I'd change, believe me. You wouldn't be off air for about 8 hours. I was just talking about the things I'd change. In the second book, this is going to sound awful, but I really mean it. I don't think there is. I think in the first book, one thing that I do regret, and that is, The main female character in the first book wasn't strong enough. And I'll throw my hands up to that now. Kate in the first book wasn't strong enough. And I don't think I did her a service as a character. I should have done more for Kate. In the second book, I've gone out of my way to make female characters who were strong, to the extent that there's two strong male characters and there's three strong female characters in the second book. And I would love to hear from people down the line, you know, if I'm lucky that people buy it. But that's one thing that I'd love, is to hear from people and say, actually, yeah, you know, you did. Those women stand alone. I'd love that, you know, because then I'd feel like I'd done a decent job on it, you know.
Okay. Well, now the part that I love to, and we've mentioned quite a few things, Tony, but I love to talk about the writer's experience, because I know that for this program, a lot of writers are listening, those that have been, that are self-publishing, publishing, or haven't published yet. So one of the things we want to know is, did you learn anything from writing your books, and what was it?
Yes, loads. Honestly, you couldn't say one thing. The most important thing I learned from it was, don't work alone, because sometimes it can become, you can get a little bit tunnel vision with it, and you can kind of become a little bit, you can go down alleyways that you realize that you shouldn't have gone down when you talk them over with other people. You know, you can only mm-hmm. be so introspective, and although I'm not a member of a writers group or anything like that, I do kind of think that maybe that would have been a good thing for me now, because when Nat sent me back his editorial notes when we first got it through, there was little blind alleyways that I'd sort of drifted along that had I been in maybe a writers group or something, I probably wouldn't have done. So I think sharing your work, you know, as a working process amongst other people who are interested is important. Don't give up. Just do not give up. Even if, you know, you're doing it for 30 years, just don't give up. Because I tell you, if you keep going and keep battling and keep pushing and keep sharing and just putting your work out there, it's the best feeling in the world, you know, and that's such an important thing, is that I've learned never to give up. When you get stuck, never give up.
What is your least favorite part of publishing, or the process, the writing process?
I don't know if there is. I've got a worst part. I'm so lucky. Do you know what, genuinely I'm, you know, because I've had some, like I say, I've had some terrible, terrible jobs, and I'm kind of a fairly positive kind of person who will make the most of anything that I do. I always try and make the most of anything that I do, but if I think back to, when it comes to publishing, I love it all, you know. I love the editing process. I love that thing, because say if I'm working with... I did a book event a couple of weeks ago with a guy called Chris Ryan, who's a British writer. And Chris said that he hates editing. He said, I hate it. He said, I hate that thing about having to go back and edit stuff. And then I was thinking, when you plant a garden, I'm Britain's worst gardener. Yeah. You know, this myth about everyone in England can grow rose bushes. They can't. I can't. I'm the exception to that, right? But I love that idea of going back, where you see gardeners who have beautiful gardeners who go back and prune stuff and clip stuff and that for me is like editing, that I can explore things and find things that, you know, that I didn't notice before, and I can develop and colour in and stuff, and so I enjoy that. I enjoy book events because I'm a bit of an old showman at heart, so I love all that kind of thing going on. Booth events and sitting in front of audiences, that's amazing. And it does kind of swallow your life, there's no getting away from that. So maybe if that's a negative, I do spend too much time doing what I do in that respect, but to me that isn't too much time because I love doing it. Do you know what I mean? So but I think that maybe if, you know, in 20 years time, 30 years time, if I look back, I'll probably say, I sat in the office for 12 hours every day and didn't speak to anyone. But at the moment, I love it, so I can't really complain about it, you know? So, no, genuinely nothing. I love it all. I'm so lucky. I genuinely am so lucky. I really can't complain.
What would you give aspiring writers? What kind of advice? And I know you said quite a few things, but if you had to say the most important thing, what advice would that be?
I wrote a blog post not long ago saying, forget spelling and learn selling, because you've really got to start, even if you're sitting down with a blank page and it's going to be a novella or it's going to be a blog post or it's going to be a full series of books, even as you're writing the first chapter, you have to be thinking about sharing and selling it. And that's, you've got to, it's constantly, you can't wait until you get to the end and then think, right, okay, I'll start sharing and, you know, exploring how this book is going to get out there to people. What I would say is you've got to start sharing straight away, and be that on Twitter or Facebook or groups like Stoosh PR or whatever, you know. There's lots of really good hashtags on Twitter, like I'm Writing and Writer's Life and stuff, all of these kind of hashtags that enable you to share and share other people's work. And also you're learning, not only just from that, you're learning. It's not just about selling your own book, you're learning stuff about marketing and, you know, so that'd be a big thing. Leaving aside the whole don't give up thing, just start thinking immediately about it. At the end of the day, even if you don't want paying for what you do, even if you're not, you don't care about that, and you're just doing it for art and for art's sake, it's important that you think about sharing what you're doing and, you know, spreading the word about yourself. So that'd be my big thing. Think about that.
What is your best marketing tip, and how much marketing do you still spend, how much marketing time do you spend on marketing your own work?
When it comes to marketing time, there's never enough time. Before, 5 minutes before we came on air, I was talking to my publicist. Like today, I've done an hour-long interview with the Huffington Post. I've written a blog post. I've had a 20-minute conversation with my editor, and I've spoken to my PR in New York. So there's never enough time for marketing. You've got to do it, you know, especially if you want to work for a, you know, as I'm lucky enough to do, to work for a big publishing house. You've got to really spend a lot of time. And even that, though, I mean, but that can be fun because I enjoy blogging. So I do a lot of, like, Goodread blogs and stuff like that, which are fun, you know, they're nice to do. And so it can be a good thing. And also it's good writing exercise. You know, it's like doing marketing, invariably you're writing. So it's a good, fun thing to be doing. It shouldn't be a chore, really, although it can be. It shouldn't be. And you can do things like... You know, I've got a great job. You know, someone walks in the room and goes, I thought you were writing. I can say, no, I'm doing marketing on Facebook. Do you know what I mean? It's so
you can, right.
You know, it always gives you that good excuse, you know. So that'd be... The best way for me to do it is Goodreads is important. Twitter, all of that kind of Facebook stuff, you know. And the beauty of the modern internet is that a lot of it, the vast majority of it, is free. You know, you've got this thing where you can join Goodreads for free and they'll give you a platform, or Blogger, or, you know, all of these kind of great blogs. And but you can't do it in a tunnel. You've got to look, you know, you've got to sort of look at the people around you and share their work. I've made friends who I've never met, you know, and good people who I've never met who have supported me and I've supported them, and it creates, it's a nice feeling. So although it's part of the job and it can be a bit of a pain, it's a nice feeling that if you can introduce someone to an editor, or if you can, you know, send out a tweet that means somebody's work gets praised, that's also a nice feeling, you know. So share a lot. That's your mark, I think.
Okay. Well, one of my last questions, Tony. It's been great having you on the program. It really has been.
I don't have to talk a lot, though. You know.
I have to say, you know, when I come to the UK, definitely I have to try that amazing coffee. I'll hit you on Facebook before I leave and say, you know, I'm going to be there and I'm expecting amazing coffee.
I should start blogging about coffee, the coffee blog I'll start calling, Jittery or something like that, I'll call it.
I have to say, when I got to the end of Darkest Hour and I read your acknowledgments, and I have a question I usually ask, but I purposely put it on hold because when I read this page, I was like, oh, it was just, I mean, I've read a lot of acknowledgments, but this was truly a heartfelt one. And I would have normally said to you, asked you, who has been the people that have supported you, because support and encouragement is, I think it's very important for creative individuals, and all creatives that are listening to me can understand this. And I just want to read this first part, and then I want you to just, you know, continue. You said, I used to think that being a writer would be a lonely job. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong. I'm a lucky man, and this page will show you why. I really couldn't have written this book without the nudging and encouragement. That really got me. And I know some of the people in your acknowledgement, but, you know, for creative people, it's hard to ask for support, I think, the majority. And it's also, you know, pretty hard when you start if you feel that you don't have support. So tell me a little bit about the people that you acknowledge on this page.
The thing about being difficult to ask for support, there was a brief period a few years ago when I was like homeless, you know, and I was sleeping in a car, and I didn't tell people my circumstances, and I didn't tell people how much I was struggling and stuff. So I fully get that, you know, it is difficult to ask for support. And what makes the people so special in those acknowledgements, and honestly, I'm just listening to you saying that, there's kind of, it's quite moving for me, because they're still all around me now, and they're still there, and they're still supporting me, and still being mentors and generous, and it's so amazing that there's people who will do things for other people for no benefit to themselves. And I think if you can carry that forward, people like Jane at Stoosh, I've got a friend, people who've become really, really close friends, like Tracy Edges and Ian Collins and Joe, you know, these amazing people who just kind of see that you're being honest, kind of see that you're not trying to manipulate anyone, you're not trying to be greedy, and you're not trying to be cruel, you're just trying to make your situation better by being creative and being honest. And people who acknowledge that are so important in life, you know. And if you can be one of those people, this is something which I always have to try and remember myself, you know, that if you can be one of those honest people, if you can be that better person, then one day you might be lucky enough to be loved as much as I love those people in the back of that book who, you know, are so good and deserve a lot more than, you know, an acknowledgement in the back of my rubbish book, you know. It's that thing about, so that's what we've all got to aim for, really, I guess. We've all just got to try and be better.
I have to say, this is probably one of the second most, your acknowledgement page is probably one of the second most encouraging pages I've read, and I'll say personally as a writer, because one of the first ones that someone sent me a long time ago when I first started writing, they sent me an excerpt from The Shadowland of Dreams by Alex Haley. Yeah. And when I was reading yours, it reminded me of that, because it just reminded me of how he was really holding out for his dream of being published. And it was kind of funny, a couple of things. He mentioned a couple of other celebrities that weren't celebrities at the time. It was kind of funny. One place he used to go was a little restaurant, and if somebody ordered steak, they would have to run out and go buy a steak. and come back and cook it. That's how poor they were. But your page reminded me of that story for Alex Haley, of how he got his first book published, and it was just, you know, how he held out, kept to his dream.
You you owe it to yourself. Everyone owes it to themselves, you know, to just keep going, you know. And I know it sounds ridiculous now, you know, but as I'm sitting looking at, I've got like five books in front of me, which you've all got my name on the spine, and I find it difficult to believe that that's happened. But the thing is that it does happen. People can do this. And that you might be sitting in your room and you know, you're being rejected by editors or you're being rejected by publishers. You can't let that stop you. You cannot let mm-hmm. it happen. And as long as you learn from those rejections, if they're valid, if they're valid rejections, you know, then, you know, because some of them are just a waste of time, you know, some rejections
right.
are, you can tell that people are just buried on the work and just can't be bothered reading what you're submitting. But if it's a valid criticism or if they give you feedback, if you
right.
can learn from that and keep moving forward. There's a character in Joe Pike in the Robert Crace books. And mm-hmm. Joe Pike has a tattoo on his arm, red tattoos on his arm. And somebody mm-hmm. one day says to him, what are those red tattoos? They're like, he's got two red arrows tattooed on his arm, both pointing, you know, in one direction. And somebody says to him, what's with the tattoos? What are they for? And Joe says, they're to remind me to keep moving forward. Just keep
yeah.
moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think mm-hmm. that that's a thing which is resonates with me, because you can worry about what's happened in the past. You can worry about what you've lost or what you had and what's gone. And you can remember it. But you shouldn't dwell on it. You should keep looking forward. Keep your eyes near your
uh-huh.
eyes and keep fighting. Keep pushing. Don't let anyone beat you and you can get there.
Well, Tony, thank you. We've come to the end of our program. And I know you can find Tony's books on Amazon, but Tony, are there some other places you'd like to let us know where we can maybe hear your, you know, read your blogs and
you can find,
we might purchase the book?
Probably the easiest place to link to everything on me is on Twitter. I'm big on Twitter in that I just... when I'm supposed to be writing, I'm on Twitter, so you'll see me a lot there. But you can get me on the Tony Shuey, which was my old nickname when I was a kid, which is Tony, TonySHOEY, Tony Shuey. And also, if you just Google Tony Schumacher, writer, I come up, I'm on Facebook there, I've got a website, I've got everything, I'm pretty much all over that. But The Darkest Hour and the British Lion, Tony Schumacher, you'll find me there. In fact, no doubt, if you Google that, I'll probably turn up at your house and thank you personally. So there you go. That's out. Just to get me out of writing the third book, you know.
This has just been great, Tony. I would like to say,
I'm
for
really
anyone who purchased the book, please write a great, you know, please write a review for Tony on Amazon or wherever you purchase the book. We'd love to hear your reviews.
Write a review for anyone, any author that you pick a book up
yes.
for. Please write a review for me, by the way. But any
write
author that
review.
You pick up and say hello mm-hmm. to them. If everyone's got, we're all over the internet now. Say hello to the author. We love it. Honestly, we absolutely
true.
Love it. It's great. You know that, don't you? Yeah. So it's great. It really is.
Well, you know, when I first started the show, I used to say my mentor who got me into this. I used to say, I like that writer. And he would say, well, just contact him and ask him on the show. And I'm like, really? He's like, really? And it's really kind of been fun, because I'm always, even after all this time, I am still excited when an author says yes.
Yeah,
so I'm
well,
like,
you know,
oh, yeah, I'm just, you know.
I'm exactly
so
the same.
The same way, huh?
If I meet an author, you know, if I meet a famous author, if I meet an author and they say they're an author, I get excited and I forget that I'm one as well, you know, but I love it. It's great.
Well, thank you so much for being a part of our program today. Just for our audience, thank you for our support. You've been listening to A Taste of Ink Live with author Tony Schumacher, whose newly released book is The British Lion. Definitely, if you haven't read The Darkest Hour, you've got to read The Darkest Hour first. And I just want to also just say, just, you know, for everyone who's a part of this program, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate you for making everything go well for us today. And Tony, thank you again for being a part of the program. The program will be advertised. You will find it on Vertical Life Magazine online by this weekend. You'll be able to also hear the podcast, and we'll still be promoting it to our groups. It's been a great interview with Tony, and I would love for you to hear his story. And thank you again, Tony.
Thank you so much, Celeste, and thank you to everyone who's out there.
Thank you, everyone. And everybody, we're going to close out our program with Deep Cover by Steve Thompson and the Incidents. Again, you can find them at facebook.com, The Incidents, great group. And thank you again for being a part of A Taste of Ink Live. Bye-bye. Have a great day.